You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is March 1st, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me tonight are Perry DeAngelis.
Happy March, everybody.
Evan Bernstein.
Happy Ash Wednesday, everybody.
And Bob Novella.
Hello.
How are you guys doing tonight?
Oh,
pretty
great.
Good.
Jim Dandy.
Excellent. How's the weather?
I'm actually recording tonight from sunny Jupiter, Florida.
Oh, so you've retired.
I wish.
On it's got to be sunnier than up here. We're expecting snow in the Northeast tomorrow. Thank you.
It'll be sunnier in the 80s tomorrow down here.
Yeah. It's tough life, isn't it?
It's beautiful. Beautiful. Good week. Good week to be down south.
Tough life.
We're jealous.
Taking a little time out from my busy vacation to do the podcast. Always dedicated.
Of course.
We do it all for you, folks.
Now, we get a lot of feedback about the time of our podcast. Almost everyone who writes us an email says, "Love the podcast. I even get anxious when you guys are late in posting your podcast." So it's kind of... you know, it's nice that they say that, but they all notice when we're late in putting up the podcast. Well, I wish we could be more consistent in doing it. We actually have been very good in the last 6 months of putting one up every week. We definitely record one every week. But the post-production takes a variable amount of time, basically because, unfortunately, we all have real lives where we have to, like, you know, work and take care of families and stuff. So
go on vacations, stuff
like that. So real life intervenes, and it may take, sometimes I can get it done the next day, sometimes it takes, you know, 4 or 5 days. So there might be a little variability, but we have been very consistent. There always will be one per week. And they'll be up on the web usually sometime between the Saturday to the Monday after we record. So that's the sort of the window we're going for. So just be patient with us. You know, hopefully when we get a big production staff, we'll be able to be more consistent. But for now, we'll have to muddle through with what we have.
As a side note, we are expecting to get new equipment relatively soon. So we're hoping the audio quality will increase.
We've been making steady incremental technical improvements over the last few months, but now we're gonna do an equipment upgrade and hope that takes it up another notch. Hope you've been noticing. One quick news item tonight on the evolution versus intelligent design front. Since the Dover, Pennsylvania decision, there have been a number of legislatures or school boards who have either canceled or scuttled or opposed either standards or bills or legislation to either anti-evolution or pro-intelligent design. And recently, just yesterday, this item was posted in Salt Lake City. Their House lawmakers scuttled the bill that would have required students to be told that evolution is not empirically proven. The bill sponsor was a Republican state senator, Chris Buttars, B-U-T-T-A-R-S, said it was time to rein in the teachers who were teaching that man descended from apes.
Those goofy Republicans.
his bill failed to pass. So I think what is happening is that the legislatures don't want to pass laws that are going to be overturned in the judiciary.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Which, you know, makes sense. So they're saving the court some time, which is good, you know, that these laws are being pushed back even further.
Good.
It's very consistent. I haven't read or heard of anything going the other way, really, since the Dover decision. So I think we're in a good time in terms of, you know, rolling back and pushing back these anti-evolution laws.
Absolutely.
This guy says, Buttar says, "I don't believe that anybody in there really wants their kids to be taught that their great-grandfather was an ape."
For God's sakes.
Yeah.
How often are we going
to Certainly I wouldn't want to be told that, because it's not true.
I mean, what year? What yeah, year is it? What year is
That's
it?
That's true.
That
it's
is
true.
So. Boy. That is so. Scopes monkey trial.
Wow.
Your granddaddy was an ape, a monkey.
And a big problem with that is he probably doesn't even really believe that. He's just saying it to inflame yeah, well, people.
He's certainly evidence of de-evolution. I don't know about evolution.
I mean, he certainly has a very limited understanding of evolution, but even he, I don't think, I mean,
that's,
believes
that's
that.
That's hyperbole. That's hyperbole. But,
yeah, it, but, is, it is. It's very useful. It's useful.
How old is the Earth? Well, that's
6,000 years old.
6,000 years.
Bishop Usher. I'm more interested in the Rock of Ages than the Age of Rocks. Yes, go ahead. What?
Another item on the religion front.
I stole that from Inherit the Wind. I have
yes,
to give proper
did.
Credit.
You
know.
So a Connecticut man trying to make a quick buck on eBay with a piece of metal. Now, this piece of metal happens to have what he claims is the face of Jesus on it. At least it's a little bit more substantial than the grilled cheese that was selling on there last year. I'm sure you guys remember
right.
that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. Are you kidding?
The Virgin.
Yeah, at least it won't rot away.
Hey, you could put it on your wall or something, you know.
That's true. Yeah, well, I think the current bid is over $1,000 for this.
That's correct. As of tonight, the bid, $1,025. Bidding ends 1 week from tonight, folks, so get your bid in. I think you can buy it now for $10,000, if I'm not mistaken.
A mere $10,000.
That's not bad.
There's a button somewhere.
Buy it
so,
now.
So who knows? You know, there's obviously people cashing in on this stuff. There are also other products out there on eBay, you know, claiming to have other likenesses of
there's
Mary,
all,
Jesus.
All sorts of relics and artifacts.
Now, funny, Joseph never gets, never appears on anything. I wonder why that is. It's always Mary and Jesus.
I loved in the article, somebody said to him that it looks like Jim Morrison to me. That was great.
Yeah, right. Now, what's it doesn't really say what the image is in. Is it just in the pattern of the burnished sheet metal, is that, or is it? There's no rust or paint or anything on it, right?
No, from the pictures, it almost looks like it's an oil stain of some kind. Like there's a very fine coat of oil. Although I'm sure you know they've put their, well, maybe they haven't, but tried to smear it, you know, to see if it is just some oil. But if they did that, perhaps they would, you know, ruin something.
Right.
That is otherwise is going to yield them some money. Listen to here's the description on eBay. I'll read it to you. It's pretty short. Here's how they describe it. The sellers: image of Jesus on sheet metal, unpacked right from the crate. I had to do a double take. I was totally amazed. Several people, you can actually see an image of him with his arms in the air, or a frontal and a side image of him. Okay,
whoa.
So I guess...
Like mugshot.
Yeah,
and here's,
really?
Here's
exactly.
He said, I felt chills when I held it. Okay, so here he is, Manchester, Connecticut, February, 25 degrees outside, holding a piece of sheet metal. What do you think you're going to feel when you
chills.
Hold a piece of sheet metal? I felt chills when I held this.
I bet you
oh,
did.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the Jim Morrison comment is classic because, you know, of course he doesn't see the face of Jesus. What he sees is a, you know, a vague resemblance of a human face, and he just assigns it the meaning that he wants it to have, but it could be anybody.
Just doing a quick search on eBay, we have an image of Jesus on wood. We have an image of Jesus on pita bread. There's actually a piece of pita bread here with an image of Jesus on it. We have a photo of Jesus in the clouds taken from a plane. We
that
have
one is crusty. That picture has been circulating for decades.
The one on the clouds, the
yes,
cloud one?
Oh, yes. I've seen so many different iterations of that photo.
We have an image of Jesus on a soft drink lid. In fact, there are a great many images of Jesus out there.
In fact, if you want another website to go to see even more, there's a very funny website called whatwouldjesussee.com.
Uh-huh.
And if you go there, they have captured images of Jesus on, let's see, we have, of course, the sheet metal of recent news is on there. There are doors, you know, the wood grain of doors. There's the Virgin Mary on a basketball backboard, you know, the board behind the behind the hoop. There's, of course, the cheese sandwich. There is the dent in a car that looks like Jesus. There's the fishbone that looks like Jesus on the cross. Very good website. You should take a look at it sometime. WhatWouldJesusSee.com.
It's pretty good, right? That's
pretty funny. Guys, I'm looking at the auction right now, and one thing that strikes me is that, I mean, it looks like just some random image, you know, pareidolia is kicking in, and it's an interesting image. I mean, you could clearly see, you know, the depression of the eyes and the nose and things. But one thing that seems to be missing, I mean, usually when you see an image of Jesus on something, one of the big features that I think makes it very identifiable is the long hair.
Right.
Don't you think? Right. I mean, you could really put a vague image of anybody anywhere, and if you put the long hair on him, you could say that's Jesus.
Right.
There's no impression of hair here at all. It's just the face, the forehead down to the chin, and it's a little indistinct as you get closer to the chin. But it's just no hair here at all. I mean, this looks like Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman.
Fine actor.
I mean,
yeah, of course.
I mean, you could literally say this is anybody. It's just a generic face, and I don't see any hands or at all.
I don't quite get it.
Described as hands.
I've seen better likenesses of Jesus on other objects and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it could be oil. It's probably some sort of, you know, iridescence or thin film interference. And some oil got in there. It doesn't take much oil because, you know, oil spreads so thin. You just need a tiny drop of it. It actually spreads so thin because it has very little surface tension, and it can get so thin that it's roughly equivalent to the wavelength of light. So it spreads super thin, and that's what this could be.
Right.
Well, actually, Bob, speaking of oil, why don't I use that to segue into our email section? We got several emails about the podcast last week. The first email is from Rob Van Nostrand in Nova Scotia, Canada. He writes, hello, I love your podcasts. Keep up the good work. Two questions.
And we love Nova Scotia, by the way.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I'm going to read his second question first, though we could talk about that one. I'll save his first question till later because we actually have another email about the same question, so I'll deal with them both at the same time. So his second question was, I don't know if this fits into your mandate or not, but I keep getting confused by the various opinions about the end of oil crisis, in particular the wide variances in the peak oil point, plus or minus 30 years. Some say we crossed this point in December 2005. Others seem to suggest it's still way off. The frustrating thing for me is that we know that we will run out of oil within the next 100 years. It seems odd that more action isn't being taken now. So, we don't want to get too much into the whole political question of what to do with the oil, but the scientific question is basically, how much oil is there? How much oil can we get to? When are the supplies going to start running out?
That's the problem. It is, I mean, estimating the reserves is very scientific. I mean, there's going to be a certain amount of uncertainty in the estimates, but it wouldn't be a huge uncertainty. The problem is that the actual figure itself is the whole process is such a political thing.
Right.
I mean, first off, you've got governments. I mean, what's their incentive when governments own like 90% of the reserves? I mean, what's their incentive for giving the best number that they can come up with? I mean, it's probably not to their benefit to actually do that in a lot of cases. And companies and oil companies, it's the same thing. I mean, for commercial reasons, I mean, they're not going to tell you, hey, this is exactly, you know, what we got. So it's such a political thing,
right,
that it's very hard. It's very hard to determine, you know, what the actual reserves are. Let me throw some estimates that I gleaned from a quick search of the web. One guy here was saying that we've reached peak, that we're going to reach peak this year.
Mm-hmm.
Now that means that we've exceeded, you know, 50%, and that the gains are going to show a slow decrease. And this guy sounds very, very reliable. I mean, I was very impressed with this description of him. He's his name is Colin Campbell. He helped find found the London-based Oil Depletion Analysis Center, and apparently he's got no financial agenda, which is appealing to me for for an unbiased opinion. And he's spent his entire life on the front line of oil exploration on multiple continents. He's a chief geologist for Amoco. So this guy, I mean, it sounds like this is a pretty reliable source, and he's saying that,
motive for putting up the website?
This was an interview I believe he did for The Guardian actually last year. So he's predicting this year that we're going to reach the peak amount. But
I mean, what's his motive, Bob? He started the Oil Depletion Analysis Center. What? Why? Why did he do that?
I guess to try to come up with the best figure possible, and in determining how much oil we actually have left. But even this guy, he's basing it on estimates. And, it's only as good as the estimates he's getting. So, you go to the U.S. Geological Survey, and they're saying that peak production won't come for 30 years. Then you've got the International Energy Agency. They're saying between 2013 and 2037.
So it's all over the map. The information's useless.
It is. I mean, it's just, first off, to really give a good scientific assessment, I figure that can't be very cheap, and you've got the whole political aspect of it. So it's there you go. I mean, either way, we got to turn the search for an alternative energy source into like a Manhattan Project. I mean, come on, let's do it. Even if we had millennia of oil left, there's still plenty of good reasons to get off oil.
Right.
I mean, let's just do it. Come on. I mean, what Bush, the initiatives Bush has set into motion the past month are great, but man, let's do more. Let's keep it up, and let's do more and more than even what he suggested.
The part of the problem is that oil is still a really cheap source of energy. So it's not very – there's no economic incentive at the moment.
Well, we're getting there.
Until oil starts to run out, so we'll see. I think just getting back to sort of the scientific question of how much oil is left, there's a lot of variables to consider. It's like estimating what's the probability of life existing in the galaxy. Well, you have to make a guesstimate on so many variables, and the error bars get magnified for each time you have another variable, and so the error bars you end up with can be orders of magnitude. So, for example, with oil, we don't know how much oil is actually in each reservoir that we have. You drill a hole in the ground, and I'm sure the geologists have lots of ways of estimating how much oil is down there, but they don't really know. The other part of it is that the technology for extracting the oil is evolving.
Right.
And, for example, if you do high-pressure steam injection into a used oil well, you may start to get more oil out, and we don't really know how much more oil. It may be another 50%. It may be three times as much as what was originally in there.
Right.
So that's a huge variation that we just don't know. So do you take optimistic or pessimistic estimates of all of these variables? And will we find new reserves? That's who knows.
So, I mean, the bottom line, the answer to this question is currently unknowable.
Well, it's
right?
I think you can say that it falls within a certain range, and here are the error bars, but the error bars are huge. I don't think that we have 1,000 years of oil left.
Right.
I think
right.
that there's a broad consensus for that. I think that most of the estimates are less than 100 years in terms of reaching our peak.
Well, Steve, a lot of the most recent estimates don't really go too far beyond surprisingly 2020.
Right.
So that seems very telling to me, and even more reason why we really got to start pouring billions of dollars into this.
No, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if you guys ever heard of oil shale.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the oil shale has a lot of oil in it, and you can make gasoline from oil shale. But,
right.
It costs more per gallon than just pumping it out of the ground. Now.
I understand.
Right.
But here's a statistic I found, though. The United States Office of Naval Petroleum and Oil Shale Reserves estimates the world supply of oil shale at 1.6 trillion barrels, 80% of which are located in the United States.
And that sounds that's a big number, but how much of our oil use is that?
Right.
Right, yeah.
That's a good that's a good chunk, Steve.
Still, it's a lot harder to get oil out of shale, like we said.
That's right. It's a more
much more expensive.
Process. Yeah.
Right. That's the big problem. That is a big number, and that would last decades.
Right.
What is oil today? About $60 a barrel.
Yeah.
In the United
States, 66, something like that. 66, 67. Yeah.
That's still cheap. I mean, that's about 10 cents a cup. It's, you know, it's still cheap fuel, boy.
It's cheaper than bottled water.
Yeah.
It's, of course, bottled water is a rip-off.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
Whole nother.
Rob's second first question, which I'm going to read second, is this. Regarding the G-Spot article, you might be interested in a recent podcast by Audible's In Bed with Susie Bright. She provided some additional insights that would seem to point out the flaws in the quest for quote-unquote nerve endings on the G-spot. It appears that it is not on the surface but well beneath the surface and triggered more by internal pressure. He jokingly says, I'll have to experiment with my wife. She references another website with some information, gspotcenter.com. Again, this will be on our notes. So again, you know, saying that the reason why, again, just to quickly summarize what we discussed last week with Terrence Hines, which was our guest. Terrence had published an article called The G-Spot, a Gynecological Myth, where he basically said that there's no published scientific data establishing the existence of a G-spot physiologically and anatomically. That specifically, if you look at sections, pathological sections of the vaginal wall, there is no area that's any different than any other area, and specifically there's no area that has higher concentration of nerve endings which is what one might predict would exist if there were a spot which is more sensitive. Now, he wasn't necessarily saying that the G-spot doesn't exist, just that he was surprised to find that there was no evidence to support its existence, and that there are certainly other explanations for possible explanations for the anecdotal sort of experience that a G-spot may exist. The other email that we got was this. The sender requested that we do not use her name, but she writes, first of all, I'd like to say that I've been listening to your podcast for several months and I enjoy it greatly, even to the point of getting irritated when you haven't posted a new one in a while. It's refreshing to listen to people who are,
here we go.
Is which prompted my earlier comment, who are so dedicated to the scientific method and to cutting through some of the malarkey that passes for information these days. Keep up the good work, guys. Well, thank you.
Here, here.
Yes, we will. We will continue.
Here. With that said, I have to respectfully disagree with your recent show where you debate the existence of the Grafenberg spot and female ejaculation. Please pardon my boldness, but in the interest of science, I'm going to get quite graphic here. She sends me a link to a G-spot website, which I looked at, and it's, you know, it's just, there was no scientific evidence on the site. It was just, this is how you find it. This is, you know, you could buy stuff to help you stimulate it, blah, blah, blah.
She has a nerve to disagree with us. This is an outrage. All right, she can disagree this one time.
Funny you used the word nerve there, Perry.
it's all so part of the cerebral nature of the podcast.
She basically sends her anecdotal experience with the fact that there is such a thing as a G-spot and female ejaculation. So I had some time after getting these emails. I actually did a literature search on the G-spot just to see what's being published on this. I found Terry Hines' article, bunch of letters, nothing else really recently except for one thing. There was one article, you know, these are like technical medical articles, not opinion pieces, that were published on it. Very interesting. It wasn't really specifically trying to address whether or not the G-spot exists or not, but the implications of the article are very interesting. The title is The Electrovaginogram, Study of a Vaginal Electric Activity and Its Role in the Sexual Act and Disorders. So basically, it is sort of an anatomical, physiological study looking at the electrical activity of the nerves in the vagina. Now, what they found is that the vagina has a pacemaker, what they're calling the vaginal pacemaker, which is cells in the vaginal wall which cause the vagina to contract, which is the origin of the rhythmic contractions that occur during coitus. And that they hypothesize that this vaginal pacemaker is the G-spot. Now, that's very interesting because, so what they're saying is that the G-spot, if you stimulate it, that triggers vaginal contractions, which is part of a physiological response which causes heightened stimulation and arousal. So perhaps the G-spot is not any more sensitive than any other part of the vagina and therefore doesn't need more nerve endings. Perhaps the nerve endings that are there just function differently. They function as the pacemaker. So that would be a possible... That could be a way. I haven't had an opportunity to run this by Terry Hines. I'll definitely get his... I'll email him and get a response from him on this. Maybe we'll have him back to talk about it briefly. But that certainly is a very plausible alternate hypothesis for how you can have a G-spot without having an increased density of neurons, of nerve fibers or nerve endings in the vaginal wall. So I think that's a better explanation than the one that was suggested in the previous email about it being deeper. I think that's naive. I mean, you know, the whole vaginal wall has been looked at, not just the surface, and have it being pressure, you know, nerve endings. Well, those are nerve endings that you can stain and see too. So I don't think that's a good explanation. But this explanation struck me as a perfectly consistent with existing evidence. Again, it's one study. It certainly needs corroboration. We need to see to correlate, you know, the vaginal pacemaker, you know, with the psychological and physiological response of a so-called G-spot. I mean, there's lots of follow-up studies that need to be done to really, you know, ask all the questions that you can ask about that. But that's interesting. Definitely have to
certainly
that
is dietary. Yeah, that's very interesting. It is. It seems a reasonable hypothesis. It does.
Right. Yep. Right. Yep. So maybe there is a G-spot after all. And it's also, you know, brings up again, I like to talk about just the logical points that these kinds of questions bring up and their implications for skepticism in general. It's always difficult to make an argument based upon the lack of evidence.
All right.
And as we say, you know, lack of evidence or absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Right.
But that's an oversimplification. It actually is evidence for absence, but you have to put it in the proper context. And this is where I think that skeptics and believers sort of get into unresolvable disputes. If you're making an argument that something probably doesn't exist because we haven't seen it or found it yet, that always has to be coupled with a very realistic and unbiased assessment of how probable it is that we should have found it. So, for example, well, if we've never looked...
SETI,
right. SETI's a good example. So some people say, oh, you know, it's been 30, 40 years. We haven't heard any signals from aliens sending us radio signals to try to communicate with us. Therefore, they don't exist. But you have to say, well, how much of the sky have we surveyed? How much of the electromagnetic spectrum with what sensitivity and what power? So do we really expect that we have had a big chance of finding them? We had this exact dispute with the gentleman who believes in Bigfoot going back a few podcasts. Again, the fact that no one's ever hit a Bigfoot with a car or taken a really good picture or video, or there's zero biological evidence, a DNA or a corpse, basically, of a Bigfoot, was more compelling to us than to him. He thought that there was a low probability that we would have found biological evidence, and we thought that there was a high probability that we should have found biological evidence. And that's kind of an unresolvable judgment call. You know, how do you quantify the chance of finding an unknown entity? You can't do it.
Right.
So anyway, it's the same thing. And the same, even though as different as Bigfoot and the G-spot allegedly are.
I think we're onto something here.
It's the same point of logic that, you know, Terry Hines was saying, hey, no one has found anything physiological that can correlate to a G-spot. And the believer said, but we haven't really looked, and there could be something else that we're not thinking of. And in this case, you know, they may have been right. I mean, not that they haven't looked, because we have looked. We've taken sections, and it's been explored. But, you know, this is a completely different approach, you know, thinking of it not as increased density but different type of neurons, that, you know, that's always the variable when you're basing a conclusion or an argument on the on a lack of evidence, that there could be a kind of evidence that no one has even thought of yet that that can hit you.
You're a neurologist, Steve. That is a reasonable explanation. I mean, neurons that act differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Those kind of pacemaker, you know, function of neurons is well established.
Okay. Right.
So, and they're, you know, the evidence that they have found a vaginal pacemaker is preliminary, I think. You know, so again, it needs further exploration, but it's perfectly reasonable. It's nothing
right
earth-shattering in just that that implication right there.
Very, very interesting.
One more email. This one comes from a gentleman who calls himself Aram, A-R-A-M. He writes, "I'm an avid listener. I've downloaded all your podcasts and listen to them every day while I drive. I've learned a lot from you guys, especially with science or fiction." Well, thanks, Aram. We enjoy science or fiction very much as well. Anyway, I have a question about Zachariah Sitchin. I haven't read his book, The Twelfth Planet, yet. However, I do know about some of the claims he makes. I wanted to know what you think about Sitchin's interpretation of the Sumerian tablets and that we come from a family of aliens, Anunnaki or whatever, and some revolving planet, Nibiru. I'm sure you can debunk it in minutes. I'm very skeptical about it. I heard about Sitchin in a book by Lloyd Pye. You guys remember Lloyd Pye, right?
Oh, sure.
Of course.
The author of the book, Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Yeah.
In the book, he talks about the gaps in the fossil record that our closest ancestor apes only have a few genetic defects, and we have thousands. How can it be that we have so many defects and our closest DNA ancestors have so little?
Well, first off, we don't have DNA of our closest ancestors. I mean, how could you make that assessment when we don't have a good example of any DNA from, you know, from Cro-Magnon or Neanderthal?
Well, I think he meant living ancestor. I think he meant living ancestor. I'm just assuming that what he's talking about is chimpanzees and gorillas as our closest living ancestors.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
Here's the logical problem with that question. This is the problem with the question. So.
Well, it's wrong.
Well, hold on.
Well, he's just asking. I just doesn't understand why is it that human beings have so many more. Now, what he calls genetic defects, a geneticist would call a genetic mutation, which is technically, you can't think of it as a defect, but that implies that one gene sequence is correct and another one is incorrect. So it's really kind of a misnomer. It's when we use mutations because it just means that they're different. So what that means is that if you look at any protein, in humans, you look at the gene, maybe there's 1,000 base pairs in the DNA sequence that codes for that protein, and there may be, you know, 20 or 30 different varieties or genetic varieties of that protein if you across the human spectrum. You can have lots of mutations in the DNA sequence that do not affect the protein at all. A lot of mutations are what we call silent mutations. Silent mutations, in other words, different combinations of three base pairs may code for the same amino acid. So that means there's literally zero difference in the final protein structure. Those mutations cannot be altered by evolution because there's no phenotype. There's no effect to them. So basically, when those mutations occur, there's no evolutionary selection against them. That has led to the creation of what we call a molecular clock or a DNA clock. So these mutations should happen on a regular basis, just on the basis of the stability of the DNA molecule and the efficiency of the repair mechanisms. So they basically pop up in DNA based upon the size of the DNA over a period of time. And we've used this to decide how far in the past different species have diverged from each other by comparing their DNA and seeing how many mutations they have in common and how many are different. If we have X number of new mutations that are different than, say, from chimpanzees, and that means that, you know, comparing that to the molecular clock, we must have split with them 5 million years ago, for example. So, but here's the thing. Genetic mutations will increase over time. just as a natural course. They will increase the larger the population that you have. And if you, whenever a species goes through a period of time where they have a very small population, most of these mutations, most of these genetic variations die out. And then a very few mutations become the parents, if you will, of whatever subsequent, you know, population exists. So that's what happened. You know, that happened with the human species about 200,000 years ago. That was the most recent narrow population hole that we passed through. There was probably about 2,000 individual human ancestors living at about 200,000 years ago. We were basically on the brink of extinction.
Wow.
And all the 6.5 billion people that are alive today all can trace back their parentage to those 2,000 founders. So the number of mutations that we have basically cropped up over the last 200,000 years. Chimpanzees have a much smaller population, and they passed through, you know, these constrictions of populations much more recently. So they're much less of, they're much more of an inbred population, so they have many fewer mutations than the 6.5 billion people have. Does that make sense?
All right, so that's what he was talking about.
Yeah, that's okay. What he was talking about, and that, and we know the explanation is going through these population narrowings and how long in the past.
It's a little dense, but I got it.
Yeah, it is complicated. I can understand why he just didn't understand what the answer to that is. But morons like Lloyd Pye, you know, use these, you know, somewhat sophisticated genetic arguments to claim that there's something wrong with the standard explanation for genetics and evolutionary relationships. What, the only thing that's wrong is that Pye doesn't understand the first thing of the topics that he deigns to completely denounce.
Yeah.
That's, you know, why you can write a book with the title of Everything You Know Is Wrong. I mean, because because this guy doesn't know the first thing about anything.
I always get a chuckle on that title.
Steve, so Steve, wouldn't it be interesting if we, I mean, if our population was narrowed so drastically, I mean, we might be, you know, considerably different species now, with maybe not considerably, but I mean, we might have some really bizarre mutations that would be, of course, normal if we were used to it, but from our point of view, might be like, whoa,
right.
What's,
well,
that?
You mean like
right
laser
now.
Beam eyes and wings and stuff? What are we talking about here?
Yeah,
oh, no, those are
fine. Well, you know, if you think about the degree of genetic variation in the human species today, is, you know, the different races, you know, Caucasian, Asian, African, Australian. That's the amount of genetic variation that arose over 200,000 years based upon geological separation. Separation creates, you know, disparity, diversity, and time does. Yeah, so imagine if Homo sapiens were a large outbred population but geologically separated for 500,000 years or 1,000,000 years.
Right.
You know, at some point you cross that threshold to where you're different species, but just shy of that, you can have very different races. You know, you could think of how different breeds of dogs are. All dogs are the same species,
yep.
But you have, you know, Chihuahuas and St. Bernards. Those are pretty different, but they're the same species.
Right.
And they can share genetic material. So, yeah, I mean, it would be very interesting, you know, think of the historical problem we've had with racism, which is with the disparity that we have now. Imagine if there were more dramatic differences in human races or subpopulations. It'd be interesting. Let's get to the first part of Aram's question, where he talks about the 12th planet, Zachariah Sitchin. I did not read The 12th Planet, but I did read Zachariah's website and a lot of what he's written in his articles, where he summarizes and talks about his claims. This guy's a total oddball. You know, his website, Sitchin.com, goes over his basic claims. So this guy basically believes that, you know, this is, he interpreted some ancient Sumerian texts and decided, you know, about 6,000 years old, what he calls the Sumerian cosmogony, whatever that is. and he believes that there was a large planet in our solar system called Tiamat, which was
Tiamat.
Tiamat.
The five-headed dragon.
Right, that's right. Which was, I think that's from Sumerian legend.
Yeah.
Was struck by a planet which was ejected from another solar system.
Called Chimera.
Oh, my God. Do you know the odds of a planet from another solar system hitting our solar system?
I do. I really do.
Oh, my God.
Spock does. He can quote that.
Oh, sure.
The collision created the Earth and the asteroid belt. And, the planet was captured in solar orbit, but it's farther out. It's the 12th planet in our solar system. So
okay,
there's huge problems with that hypothesis. I mean, enormous. First of all, the Earth is in such a nearly perfectly circular and stable orbit that it could not have historically had such a catastrophic collision, especially one that would have so significantly knocked it from its original orbit.
Well, Steve, don't forget, though, that in our past, I think it's pretty generally accepted that the Earth was hit by a Mars-sized object early in our formation. And so they might come back to you with something like that saying, hey, scientists agree on this, and our orbit is still
– absolutely.
Orbit is still, as you describe it.
That collision probably formed the moon. So what you had was in the early solar system, that was made from collisions. All the planets were basically the product of massive collisions. And, initially with small objects, and they got bigger and bigger. And at some point early on in the Earth's history, a fairly large object hit the Earth and split off the moon. But, that was probably something that was already kind of in our orbit.
Right. Steve, let me just quickly – I saw a simulation of what this might have been like.
Right.
Real quick. It was very interesting. This was a planet that was – like I said, it was Mars-sized. And it
which
was
in small, much smaller than the Earth.
Right, which is about – I'm not quite sure. Half, a third, something
about,
like
it's
that?
It's a third. It's one-third the diameter, I believe.
And it was in a very, very similar orbit. And at one point, it just kept getting closer and closer. And I just got this image in my head of what that last orbit would have looked like. The last time it went by us without hitting us, could you imagine what that would have looked like, having this planet shoot by your planet? That it'd be like 100 times bigger than the moon. And then of course the next orbit it knocked into the Earth and actually
cosmic billiards.
Science speculate that there actually life might have gotten a foothold on Earth before the collision, and they actually called that Earth before the collision Mark 1, and the Earth we're on now is Mark 2, in the sense that life might have been completely scrambled and started over from scratch. And if we were never hit, we could be populated with life. We would be populated with life.
We would be very
completely
different than we are now.
Completely different than what we have now.
Huh. So the upshot of that is that Newtonian mechanics, you had two objects in a similar circular orbit hitting each other and resulting in
the relative velocities wouldn't be immense.
Basically a binary system with the moon and the Earth. Still,
it's like hitting a car on the highway, traveling in the same direction and nearly the same speed you are. It's not nearly as nasty as a head-on collision.
Yeah, we're getting hit from the side, so if you imagine a planet careening in from another solar system at an incredibly eccentric orbit. And the other thing to think about, Bob, is what he's saying is that some of this material resulted in the asteroid belt, which is beyond the orbit of Mars,
which
it's between
makes no
Mars
sense,
and Jupiter.
Right.
And then the rest resulted in the Earth in this nearly perfectly circular orbit. That's also extremely impossible from a mechanical point of view.
That's quite a trick shot.
And to boot, it seeded the Earth of life at the same time. And somehow the ancient Sumerians figured all this out.
Of course.
They're brilliant.
Now, absolutely.
His website today is interesting because he tries to take credit for predicting things like collisions, saying that, when I first wrote my book, astronomers scoffed at the notion of catastrophic collisions occurring in planet formation, and now that's a mainstream part of astronomy and cosmology. That's, you know, that's nonsense. He also, his most recent thing is he's quoting the, remember we had reported recently about the finding the most Earth-like planet to date around another star.
Right.
And he's somehow trying to say that this supports his entire hypothesis. Like, see, there are other Earth-like planets out there. And isn't it interesting that this planet is about the same size and distance from the sun as what I said Tiamat was? No, it's not interesting at all. I mean, it has absolutely nothing to do with his hypothesis.
Wow.
And, you know, he's trying to, like, make it seem like astronomers doubted that there ever would be Earth-like planets around other stars. I never heard that. That's just nonsense. So, you know, he's really, really grasping at straws, trying to trump up, you know, intervening astronomical discoveries to make it seem like it somehow supports what he said, when in fact there's zero evidence for his scenario and nothing has been discovered which supports it.
So, Steve, what was he selling?
Well, his book, you know.
Everyone's got a book.
Thing. These guys make money by giving lectures, selling books. He also has a section in here on biblical prophecies. So he's into that as well. What else does he talk about? Oh, here we go. I did want to talk about this. So now he has puzzling photographs from Mars need explanation.
Oh, my. Here we go.
These are not the face on Mars, which is old news.
The canals.
even older. But these are photos taken by the Mars rover. And these are his website. So I'm looking at one right now. So it's a very nice picture provided by NASA of the surface of Mars. You can see a little bit of the rover in the lower right-hand corner of the picture. It's a Martian landscape. And in the distance, you can see two dust devils. You guys have seen dust devils, right? It's a little swirl of dust. Yep. The surface of Mars is very dusty. In fact, during a Mars storm, Mars has dust storms, which last for days or weeks, that absolutely scour the surface.
Well, let me guess, Steve. He thinks that this little dust devil is proof of a Tasmanian devil on Mars?
That would be more logical than what he says. He writes, as one looks closely at the photographs, there are many of them. One notices incredible features. What looks like a long sand-covered wall, a black stone ring, a sand-blown conical structure and rectangular areas marked off by stone boundaries. What I see is nothing. I mean, there's nothing there. I mean, this guy has a very active imagination. You talk about pareidolia. You talk about the face of Jesus. And there's nothing on this guy. I mean, seriously, it's a horizon. It's like you're looking at the Mojave Desert, and there's a little. I mean, I can't even imagine what the guy's seeing.
Perry, or Evan, this guy would look at that sheet metal.
Exactly.
That sheet metal, and he'd see the last supper.
Exactly. I was just going to say that the whole thing, right? All 12 apostles.
Of course. So, I mean, you know, the it's just rocks scattered across a desert-like landscape. I mean, it's just, if you look at enough of these pictures of just random alien landscapes, you know, people pore over these thousands of pictures being produced by NASA, and they find all kinds of, you know, apparent things, but it's really just looking for patterns in these random pictures.
Or Steve, even obscure geological formations. And I could see that. You see something that really, a shape that you're like, what is that? How could that have been created? And, you know, you talk to a geologist and he's like, oh yeah, no problem. I mean, you could explain these things. But, I mean, people just take it to the nth degree.
Right, right. Well, let's do our science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
The theme for this week is too good to be true. So each week, I come up with three science news facts or items. Two of them are real, two are science, and one I've made up. One is fake. It's total fiction. Occasionally, my skeptical colleagues have sat in for me and done their own science or fiction, but I do most of them. And you as the audience, of course, are encouraged to play along with us. I'll read all three items and then solicit comments from my panel of skeptics. We'll see if they could figure out which one is fiction. Are you guys ready?
Yeah,
ready.
So again, these are all the sort of loose theme here is that these are all things which sound too good to be true at first blush. Item number one, scientists have built a quantum computer prototype that was able to compute the correct answer to a calculation without having to actually run. Item number two, a review of data at a recent symposium at the annual National Academy of Sciences meeting supports the claim that chocolate is healthy for the heart and has other health benefits. Item number three, material scientists from MIT have developed a process that can mass produce carbon nanofiber cables of any thickness or length. Such cables would be many times stronger and lighter than steel. So, do we have a quantum computer that can do calculations without having to actually run? Is chocolate healthy? Or can we mass produce nanofiber cables stronger than steel?
Huh.
Evan, why don't you lead off?
I'm tempted to say B is the one that was made up. However, I don't know. Boy, this is a good one. This is really good. These are all too good to be true in my estimation. You know, certainly there's some kind of appeal to that chocolate being a healthy one, like too much of an appeal in that that's the one you're trying to trip us up with. So, okay, what the heck? Why not? I'll just say that B is the is fiction here. Chocolate
Already?
Is... Chocolate's
okay,
not
number
healthy.
Two.
Yep.
Chocolate's good for you.
Evan's wrong. It's dark chocolate that's good for you. I believe I recently heard that. So Evan got that wrong. My logic just tells me that A is, I mean, I don't see how, you know, if the thing is off, it's off. I mean, you know, I don't see how it could work. I'm simply, just based on that, I'm going to go with A. I think A is false.
Okay. All right. Bob?
Both you guys are wrong.
Of course.
Steve, you're generally very good about finding these articles that I am not privy to, and I generally have to just rely on, you know, past experience to try to figure out.
Or
you've read these.
The first one, the quantum computer does exist. I read the article on it, and I actually I sent it to my home email account so that I could potentially use it in
How
a science
work
fiction,
if it's off?
Entry. That, you know, I read it. I have to read it a couple more times before I could do it justice
all
for
right,
it, so I'm not even
right.
going to attempt. But it sounded somewhat plausible. But
in my defense, Bob, I had very short amount of time for this one because I'm stuck down here
right.
in Florida. I just got internet access a couple hours ago down here. But that's I had to go to less obscure sites, so that's why I'm not surprised
right.
you've read these ones.
Now, okay. The chocolate health benefits. Yeah, I mean, I've read stuff similar to that, not recently, but that doesn't
dark chocolate, dark chocolate only.
Well, come on.
But remember, I said this is a recent symposium reviewing the data and basically supporting these claims that you may have heard in the past.
Okay.
Just to be clear.
Now, the third one, that is too good to be true. I like to think that I would have heard something about this. Mass-producing carbon nanotubes of any length? Can you say space elevator? I mean, that would be
really?
That's like the only major technological, you know, problem that we need to surmount in order to produce, you know, what you know a satellite, you know, an elevator to a satellite in space. But that's kind of like an esoteric application, but that, I mean, being able to produce them any length you want, that's the biggest problem with these nanotubes is actually making them in quantity.
You sound pretty confident.
Right.
Yeah, I am.
Is that your final answer?
Oh, it is, and if I'm wrong and it's true, I hope I'm wrong, because if that's true, that's awesome.
You don't want to use a lifeline?
No. Go ahead, okay. What do you got?
All right. Well, let's go to number one. Number one is the quantum computer can give results without the here's the the article, Quantum Computer Gives Results Without Running. Now, I had to read the article a couple of times
myself. I'll
bet
you did.
It's whenever you're dealing with the quantum stuff, I mean. So basically, this is true. The computer was trying to – it was comparing two states of, I think, of a photon, whether or not it was in one state or another. And the computer had to decide if they matched or not. That was the calculation that it was doing. So a very, very basic one bit of information kind of thing.
Right, but it's I mean, there is some sort of interaction going on.
Yeah, but they did the old beam splitter thing where
right.
The photon, it either, depending on its quantum state, it either goes through the computer or it doesn't. So it's in a juxtaposition, right, of going through and
superposition.
Not going through. Superposition, I'm sorry, you're correct, a superposition. And what they were able to show was that when it collapses and it either goes through or doesn't go through, basically when they take the measurement, that at times when they're able to prove that the beam of light did not go through the computer, it still was able to produce the correct prediction of whether or not the states matched or not. So in other words, when the photon didn't go through the computer still got the right answer. Which is amazing. Which, of course, has something to do with the whole quantum fuzziness of superposition.
Right.
It must, but
what?
Not that anybody really
I don't even know what you're
means.
Talking about. What are you? I'm serious. I'm lost.
That's
I don't even know what
it's
you're
tough.
Talking
very,
about.
I got you, Steve. Keep going.
Yep. So
okay.
Now the implications of this are huge. This is, you know, it may not sound that impressive, but it's a huge step forward for the whole quantum computing technology, and they're predicting that they can get the reliability of this process up to close to 100%, and that...
Well, what will it mean? Super, super fast computers?
What it means... Yes, what it means is computers that run trillions of times faster.
Trillions. With a T.
Well, but for certain applications, it's not like you're going to have a quantum computer on your desk running Word.
No.
I mean, that's really not going to happen. But for certain applications, like cryptography and code breaking, it's going to be wicked fast. But you can't apply it to everything like
great.
A general purpose
some
computer.
15-year-old is going to use this to hack into my MasterCard account and rip off my freaking numbers.
Right, basically.
Horrific, frankly.
Next one.
Let's go to number two.
Yeah. Of course.
The name of the article is Prescription Strength Chocolate Revisited.
Right.
Again, it's true.
Yeah.
But let me give you the upshot of this. The more common claim, and this has been encouraged by certain manufacturers of chocolate products, is that chocolate has health benefits and that the dark chocolate, as Perry
right.
said, is
ooh.
The healthy kind of chocolate. However, it's not true because mass-produced chocolate, even the dark chocolate, if you buy a chocolate bar on, you know, at the candy shop, it has none of the specific products in there that have been shown to have the health benefits. Basically, chocolate, naturally occurring chocolate, contains flavonoids, and flavonoids have a number of effects, antioxidant and other effects. Although the key is not their actually it turns out it's probably not their antioxidant effect, but in any case, that have been shown to have cardiovascular benefits. It may have some anti-cancer benefit, but the jury is still out on the net clinical benefits of chocolate, if any. There is very suggestive preclinical data and some preliminary clinical data to suggest that, you know, especially for the cardiovascular benefits. The problem is there's also some good epidemiological data in terms of native peoples that, you know, that consume chocolate. But the problem is that when big companies, you know, process chocolate, they destroy all the flavonoids. So any alleged benefit is gone.
Yeah.
Those bastards.
The key is that they've gone farther in identifying what the active compounds are in chocolate that potentially can be helpful.
Cool.
That may enable manufacturers to change their manufacturing process so that the flavonoids and the other things are not destroyed. So it may be that
Steve, make a pill out of it. Screw the chocolate.
Right, right. or you just, you know, pack them into a pill, which is the other thing you do. You know, but that's what the pharmaceutical industry has been doing for 100 years, is you find, you know, a naturally occurring, you know, herb or plant or root or whatever that has some physiological effect. You isolate, purify, identify the active ingredients, you know, do safety and pharmacological and physiological studies on them, find out dosing, and then start testing them for specific clinical applications. That's, you know, that probably will happen with this whole thing as well. But it's also possible that you may be able to buy chocolate bars that actually may have some, you know, healthy substances in them.
And I just stick a multivitamin in a Hershey bar. Right. wouldn't that be the same?
So as far as that goes, that was true. You know, I think that, again, there's still, I think, a long way to go before there's convincing clinical evidence, but that was true. The last one, was fake. That was fiction.
Damn.
Bob was exactly right. I didn't think, I thought I might just, you know, get you on that one, Bob, because you would have been so starry-eyed about the implications. But you're right. We probably would have heard about this. So carbon nanofibers have been produced. These are like little helical structures of carbon atoms that produce these very, very tiny tubes, which are super strong fibers. If you could actually make a cable out of these things, it would be much stronger than steel, much lighter. And you know, Bob already mentioned one of the applications being a space elevator. Basically, this is the idea, is like you anchor a big cable to the equator somewhere, and at the top side to a station in geosynchronous orbit, and you can just use it as an elevator to hoist things into orbit. The problem is that we don't have any material which is strong enough,
right,
so that it won't snap. So it's theoretically possible, but we don't have something to make the cable out of. Carbon nanofibers would be strong enough to support a space elevator, but the problem is that we can only make them very, very tiny. We don't have a manufacturing process where we can create them longer and thicker. So that's the next sort of technological breakthrough that we need.
Yeah, and Steve, don't forget, now carbon nanotubes have a host of other potential applications well beyond a strong rope. I mean, they could using them in computers, they're conductors or semiconductors, they could make transistors. I mean, they could do so many, there's so many potential applications of this. It's like a wonder material that's just going to explode. So
it certainly seems that way.
Why do they have
way
to be tubes? Why tubular?
They self-assemble. They self-assemble into these tubular shapes.
Oh.
And it's a very strong structure. That's the whole point. Well, good, Bob. Good job this week, Bob. You again, it helps when you actually read the science stories that I'm basing my
science course,
fiction
of course
on. But that's part of the
you used the word nano. Yeah, right. And Bob, if the word nano exists anywhere out there, Bob has read or studied up on
nano.
One else.
It's true.
So that's why Bob would have heard
about
it. As
a nano junkie. It's a disgrace.
Now, I'm very excited. I mean, apart from nanotechnology, I'm very excited about the prospects of a space elevator after reading a few articles by this one guy who's really, really pushing it. And he just made it seem something that wasn't as so much pie in the sky that maybe my great-grandkids will see. It's something that we can potentially see in our lifetimes. Based on what I've read and what this guy has said,
it'd be very interesting. It'd be a major, major project,
right? And once you have one of these things, you could build your second one. In a fraction of the time, because you have access to a pre-existing space elevator. So the second one that you build, you know. But hey, imagine, talk about a terrorist target.
That's true.
Right?
We may be technically capable of building and maintaining a space elevator before we're politically able to maintain it. It would be such a target. And how do you protect a...
It's true of a lot of things.
What would it be?
Yep.
23,000 miles?
It's a long ways out. But the main thing you'd have to protect would have to be the anchor on the Earth. I mean, you could put a flotilla of warships around it. I mean, no one's going to get near it unless they're supposed to.
If there was only one, it wouldn't be too hard to protect. If there was only one,
right?
You know,
and
it wouldn't
right
be too hard to protect.
And
it
Steve,
really
if these terrorists have access to missiles that could reach it high, you know, high up, then you've got other worries besides them attacking your space elevator. You know.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, believe it or not, we are out of time.
That's impossible.
I believe
it. That was a quick show.
Good episode, guys. I enjoyed it.
Bob, Evan, Perry, thanks for joining me again.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Always a pleasure.
Steve, I hope it's cold and rainy in Florida.
Yeah.
Your wishes will go unfulfilled.
Yeah. That's right. I'm used to it. I'm used to it.
Everyone out there, thanks for listening. Again, if you have any questions for us, please email us. You can get our email off of our website, www.thenest.com. If you want your voice to be heard on our podcast, and you can email us either a WAV or MP3 file of you speaking your question, and we'll play it on the podcast rather than just...
Wouldn't that be neat?
Rather than just reading your emails. So send us your questions. They're always enjoyable. Great. It's good to hear from our listeners. Guys, again, thanks for everyone out there. We'll see you next week. This has been your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.thenes.com. You can send us questions, comments, and suggestions to podcast@thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kinetto and is used with permission.